On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's ITRC online training, Groundwater Statistics for Environmental Project Managers. My name is Mary Yelkin. I'm coming to you from Lincoln, Nebraska. I will serve as your moderator today. I will cover just some introductory material and let you know how you can actively participate today, and then I'll turn it over to our trainers. Today's training is based off the technical and regulatory guidance document, Groundwater Statistics and Monitoring Compliance. And that guidance document is an online guidance document and is available for your use at no cost to you. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network. Just a few housekeeping items today. Today's training is being recorded, as we like to archive our training classes, and we will make that available, assuming we have adequate audio quality. Also, as we mentioned earlier, the trainers will be in control of the slides as we move through today's presentation. If you'd like to have your own copy of your slides to look at today or for future reference, you can download that from that initial training page you were directed to when you logged in today. Also, we want to hear from you, both your questions and your feedback. If you have questions, we will have question and answer breaks about midway through and another one at the end. For those of you on the phone line, you're welcome to ask your questions out loud, and we'll remind you how to unmute your phone once we get to those breaks. But for anybody at any time, you can type your question in that Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner of your screen, and then we will get to as many of those questions as we can during our question and answer breaks. If you're someone who needs documentation of continuing education, we do provide information to support you in documenting your continuing education of ITRC online training courses. And the way in that you would do that is you would fill out the feedback form, which will be available at the conclusion of today's class. There's a button for you to click at the end of that form to certify you participated. Once you submit that, a certificate of participation will be generated for you. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is hosted by the Environmental Council of States, and we are a state-led organization working with our federal partners, being Department of Defense, Department of Energy, and the Environmental Protection Agency, along with our industry affiliates, program members, academia, and community stakeholders. All these groups come together to develop guidance documents and training and other resources to help make better decisions when people are working on environmental sites. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you do plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review that usage policy and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We do have a variety of guidance documents, both online guidance documents, training courses, archives, many things that are available. So if you haven't been to the ITRC website for a while, please check that out and see what items may be of interest to you. It's now my pleasure to introduce our trainers for today. We very much appreciate them serving as ITRC volunteer trainers. Short bios are available of each of our trainers from that CLUIN training page where you logged in today. Today's trainers are Harold Templin with the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, Chris Stubbs with Ramboll, Lizanne Simmons with Kleinfelder Incorporated, and Rhonda Wrighty with Neptune & Company. So we're very pleased to have all of these individuals serve as ITRC experts and deliver this training to you today. And I'll turn it over to Harold Templin with the State of Indiana on slide number 6. Harold?
Okay, thank you, Mary. And as we get started today on the training, allow me to set the stage for using statistics to evaluate your groundwater data. In my work at the State of Indiana, I've had mounds of groundwater data sitting on my desk, coming across my desk, and people coming by and wondering, how do you know where to start? How do you know how to process this data? And it seems like there's a lot of confusion over the use of statistics to evaluate your groundwater data. The most important things in using statistics to evaluate your data is to make sure that you have adequate data quality, sufficient amount of data, and proper data management. So, are you drowning in your groundwater data? you know, what data should you use in this mound of data? And where should you stop? Start at the top, at the middle, at the bottom of the data, and what part of it do you use? So as well, is the data trying to tell you something? Is something going on in the groundwater that your data is trying to tell you about? And then one of the important things as well is, how can I make the best use of this data? As the optimization of the data, do I have enough data? Do I have too much data? And can I cut back on the amount of data that I'm getting? All these are important questions to ask about your data as it comes forward, and things that we'll hope to answer today will help you judge compliance with groundwater protection standards, determine the cleanup goals have been reached, and just help manage your groundwater data in general. So we feel that a statistical approach will help manage your groundwater data. Even if you're not a statistician, we will show you in this training how that you can be more informed consumer of statistics, help you to be confident in spotting misapplication or mistakes in that, in the statistical method, help you in reviewing the selection of which statistical test to use, and just overall understand the language of statistics. Then if you are a statistician, we feel like this training will help you with your work and conclusion, making it more understandable to the general audience. So ITRC's solution to manage your groundwater data is the Groundwater Statistics and Monitoring Compliance Statistical Tools for a Project Lifecycle, a long mouth word of title, and so let's just call it the GSMC document. And this document will help you in asking the right questions to apply statistics. It'll direct you to an appropriate statistical method and help you in maximizing the value of your data that you have. ITRC, back in 2011, put together this team to develop the GSMC document along with the training. And the team has been comprised of experts from the Department of Defense, EPA, Department of Energy, as well as industry and consultants, as well as state regulators. This diverse and expert team has worked hard to put the information together in a usable and accessible web-based document. Existing regulations differ widely and may not recognize the advantages and limitations of current statistical practices. So let's have a couple examples here where we talk about the regulatory challenges of using statistics. In the first example, we have meeting the criteria. Let's say that you've had an active remediation going on, and after that, the remediation process has been turned off. You've collected 8 samples, and the criterion for clean is 0.5 milligrams per liter. And you say, well, if I have 2 consecutive samples, that'll be good enough to show that the active remediation was a success. But what certainty can you put into that? We would suggest that you, using a statistical approach as described in our document, such as the upper confidence limit of the mean. And in this way, you can address what with the confidence that the mean doesn't go over a certain value. Both Chris and Liz will go more into detail about the meaning of the UCL later, but just as a way of understanding the language of statistics, the document will help you define what UCL means and give you different methods for determining that. And then as you can see, with the upper confidence limit of the mean being 0.689 milligrams per liter, you're above the criterion. And so that you might have a argument or suggested ways to look better at the data that you have to determine if you're meeting a criterion. Another example that I have is managing the non-detect values. I have here a long line of data collected over a long period of time, and so it may not really be a good indication of doing an upper confidence limit, but I was wanting to show the variation of non-detect values that you might have through a period of time. The open triangles or diamonds are the non-detect values, and as you can see, they started out at one value and went to another, and what may occur is they may change the method, they may change the lab, they may have a matrix interference, and we have some large number for a non-detect value. But how do you evaluate that value, that distribution? How do you determine the upper confidence limit? You might say, well, let's just simply substitute for the non-detect values. But what would you substitute? You have different values for non-detect. Would you make them all zero? Would you make them all the non-detect value, or halfway in between, some multiple of it? In this case, I had used zero for the upper confidence limit for the non-detect values and came up with a upper confidence limit for the mean of 0.0125 milligrams per liter. But our document discusses that in a case like this, probably the best method would be the Kaplan-Meier method, which looks at the distribution around the non-detect values and assigns a value for them where you can get an upper confidence limit more appropriate to the distribution. And what we have here is 0.0055 milligrams per liter, which happened to be below the criterion for this situation. You might make a decision based on an inaccurate characterization of the groundwater data by a misapplication of a statistical method. And this is described in Appendix B of a web-based document. However, applying a statistical approach found in the document helps communicate the characteristics of the groundwater data to the stakeholders and assist in explaining how the overall objective of the cleanup action is to help human health and the environment. I hope these examples highlighted how environmental professionals can benefit from the use of this web-based document. This web-based document is for the environmental project manager. You can use this document in reviewing or using statistical calculations for a report, making recommendations or decisions based upon statistics, and demonstrating compliance for groundwater projects. Building upon your technical background and environmental experience in site compliance and cleanup, you can use the ITRC document even if you don't have a special expertise in statistics or access to an in-house statistician. And during this training, we're going to show you how. So, the roadmap for our training today, laying it out for you. First, I'll discuss how the GSMC document is put together, how to use it. Then we'll discuss applying statistics to your data, have a question and answer break, then come back and have some study questions on background, compliance, trend analysis, and monitoring optimization. Then we'll have a summary and a final question and answer period at the end. The GSMC document is a web-based document that allows the user to move around the document to follow their situation. The framework of the document is based upon the project lifecycle. So what the team has done is brought together the different project life cycles in different colors, as you see on the screen there. And what they have realized is that groundwater statistical methods apply all through all these different project life cycles. It may be different statistical methods for different things, but the test will support decision making and help you move on to the next part of the project life cycle. The terminology of the framework of the project life cycle stages may vary under different statutory programs, but the team simply chose these five life cycle stages for the document. Next, the problem statements. The document explores some common project problem statements that guide decision making throughout the environmental project. And if you were to click on like one of the questions like, is there seasonality? You would go to the study questions in Appendix C where you would find the complete question and the relevance to a specific objective and purpose of that the answer provides. This question addresses the possible misapplication of identifying seasonal variation as a trend or knowing how to correct for distortion of a distribution because of seasonal variation. Next, we then see that the study questions become as a bridge between the project life cycle and the statistical approaches that you might use, whether it's to obtain your exploratory data analysis, the different methods that you might use, or even the software that you would want to use to answer these questions by running the different methods. With this understanding of the framework of the document, let me show you how it's put together. On the first page, we have this logo where the user can come into the document at any point, whether it's the project life cycles, the study questions, the software tools, or the statistical methods. And from the point they enter, they can be guided to the next section so that you wonder about, you have a specific question, you click on the collection, it'll tell you about the different methods that might be used, and then in that, in turn, the software tools that you could use to answer that question. In all in the project lifecycle stage, it's in section 4 as description. The questions are in Appendix C, as I stated. The methods are in section 5, and the software tools in Appendix D. But all these tools are, all these different sections are put together to give you a better decision for your project. The team has tried to make this document user-friendly for the project manager with cross-references and links to the study question methods and tools. The online guidance will also help incorporate information from other sources, such as the unified guidance, and explains how to calculate methods and the different assumptions with them. Also, there's links to the data quality objective process, where this is a systematic planning tool that helps define the type, quality, quantity of data needed to satisfy a specific need or use. And then also in section 9 of our document, you'll find many other statistical references and links to some of these documents. And so with that, I think we're ready to apply statistics to our groundwater data, and I'll turn it over to Chris Stubbs of Rambo.
All right, great. Thanks very much. All right, in this next section, we'll just kind of review some of the concepts from statistics that will help you as we go through the training. So just a definition, kind of a general one I made up. Statistics can be thought of as the science of drawing conclusions from data. And of course, that's what we're trying to do in our day-to-day work with our groundwater data. And there's various tools that we can draw on. We've got ones that'll help us visualize and just kind of get an understanding of the data. Some tools that can help separate the signal from the noise in the data. And in the case of groundwater, you know, the signal would be usually, for example, concentrations that might be associated with the site impacts, and the noise might just be natural fluctuation in concentrations. We can also summarize large-scale behavior to help improve our understanding, and there's some great ways of quantifying uncertainty, which can help us make better and more defensible decisions. So we're going to go through some of those elements of a statistical approach. But before we get started with that, I just wanted to go over and tell a little crime story. Nothing too serious, though. So what happened was there was a burglary of a laptop, you know, from a consultant's office. And, you know, the police were able to apprehend a suspect, and that suspect's name was Ivan Shifty. He came before the judge, and he pleaded not guilty. And then, you know, he went to trial. And the interesting thing about the trial is, of course, we always assume our defendants are not guilty, kind of by default. And then the prosecutor has to present evidence to sort of overcome that burden of proof. And if you think about this in a statistical framework, we can call that assumption of innocence a null hypothesis. It's kind of like our default assumption going into something before we've looked at the data. And then, you know, we look at the data that we have available. So in this court case, the prosecutor presents evidence, and the evidence included some pretty good evidence of fingerprints Mr. Shifty on the laptop, and they actually recovered the laptop in the trunk of his car. So quite good evidence. But then the question is, you know, is it enough to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt? You know, in this case, it was enough. But, you know, it's interesting to think about why we organize our trials like this. And basically, it's because we want to avoid making mistakes. And in particular, you know, we can kind of make two different kinds of mistakes. And the first one's probably more important to avoid, this, that if Shifty is actually an innocent of the crime, but he goes to jail, you know, that would be a pretty serious error that we want to avoid. And that, in the statistical framework, could be called a false positive error. And then the other error we could make is that he's actually guilty, but then he goes free. And that could be called a false negative error in a statistical framework. So it's quite useful to think about this, because in many cases when we're making our decisions, one of these types of errors is more important to us than the other. And it's useful to recognize that and to design the statistical approach appropriately. So if we move away from that court case example and then think about the characterization of a site, so we're in the site characterization phase of the life cycle, we don't know anything about the site, so we might kind of go into it saying that we're going to assume that the site's not contaminated unless we've got some really good evidence that it is. So that could be, again, our null hypothesis. And then this little matrix sort of shows what all the possibilities are. So we have sort of the true state of the site is either not contaminated or contaminated. And then, you know, what we actually decide is either not contaminated or contaminated. And, you know, if we end up in this box where we've gotten it correct, we say the site's not contaminated, and it really is. So that's what we're shooting for. But the false positive error, it would be when we say it's contaminated when it really isn't. We often think about that in our statistical approaches, and it's got a special name for it. We often call that probability of a false positive. We give it a Greek letter alpha. And we call that probability the significance level. So when we're, you know, doing an analysis, we kind of think about the significance level, which relates to the probability that we're making this false positive type of error. And then the other type of error is a false negative error. And then often we give that probability the symbol beta. But when we're talking about it, we often talk about instead the probability 1 minus beta, which is the probability that we get it correct. And we call that the power of our analysis. So we obviously want to have a large power. So that would be, you know, the chance that we're going to get it correct when the site really is contaminated. So we'll talk about those more as we go along and look at some examples. So just a reminder here, we want to look at both of these types of errors and think about which one might be more important. I'm sure everyone's heard about statistical significance, and this is just, you know, that basically we say it's significant if there's a very small chance that we've made a false positive error. And we often have to pick that significance level, that chance that we're making a false positive error. And, you know, that's just kind of up to us. And in different fields, different things are, different levels are selected. For example, in medicine, as kind of in our field, maybe the 5% level or 1 in 20 chance of making an error is selected. But in fields of such as physics, you know, they want to accept a much, much lower chance of this kind of error, you know, maybe up to 1 in 3.5 million. And then on the other side is the probability of the false negative error or the power of the test, which is tends to be a little bit harder to figure out. We often have to look at the data, collect the data first, because the power actually depends on the data itself and its variability, in addition to sample size and effect size, which is, you know, how big of a distinction we want to make between you know, two groups of samples, for example. So we always want to remember to check that power after we get our data. That would be part of good practice. All right, so what are the key aspects of a statistical approach? Well, we want to, for groundwater in particular, we want to develop a conceptual site model first. Everyone's kind of familiar with this. And that's important to think about when we're doing our statistical analysis. We start off by doing an exploratory data analysis, which is generally just plotting the data that we have in different ways and trying to understand if there's address any data quality issues and things like that. And then we move on to designing our statistical approach. So often we want to do this ahead of collecting all the data, so we make sure we collect enough data points. And then we finally use the data to evaluate our statistical evidence and look at the uncertainty in our conclusions. And after that, we want to make sure we check over our assumptions to make sure everything is valid. So those are the key aspects, and we'll kind of go through those one by one here. So first, the conceptual site model, or the CSM, it's like a written or graphical expression of, you know, what's going on with the site. So here's an example. Here we have a landfill, you know, here where the groundwater, which is represented by these lines here, is flowing under the groundwater and going into a river. And we have some sampling points here. These are groundwater monitoring wells where we've measured specific conductance, which is just kind of a measure of the levels of dissolved constituents. And you see the values that we've measured in the wells. And then this one over here is actually in the river, so it's a surface water sample. And this river is tidally influenced. So obviously, we're interested in whether there's been a release from the landfill. So for this example, we'll just look at the specific conductance, but you know, in general, you'd look at more constituents than just that. And we can kind of think about two different approaches to evaluating the data we have. And they are an inter-well testing approach or a intra-well testing approach. Now, the inter-well testing approach would be where we're We look at, you know, all the wells that we have, and we sort of divide them into two groups. One is the background wells, and the ones that are the kind of downgradient or potentially affected by the site. And then we compare those two groups to see if the site has caused a change between the background and the downgradient wells. The other approach, though, is intra-well testing, where we just look at one well at a time, and we divide the data from that one well into two time periods. You know, one before the landfill could have impacted groundwater, and one after. And we compare the data from those two time periods, but within one well. And based on our conceptual site model, one of these approaches might be better. So just going back here to our figure, you know, in this case, because we have this tidally influenced river, you know, it's going to affect just the river. The salinity in the river is going to affect the downgradient well. So in this case, an intra-well approach would probably be better, where we divide the data from, you know, a single well into two time periods and compare those two groups. So that's why looking at a conceptual site model can be important. All right, now the next step is the conducting of exploratory data analysis, which generally means you should just plot that data up in any different ways as makes sense. Here's sort of the top five plots that we tend to use that tend to be very useful for groundwater analyses. Time series plot, box plot, scatter plot, histogram, and the probability plot. They're all kind of useful for different things as listed here. And we'll look at some examples of these as we go along. So the first one's the time series plot, which we're kind of all familiar with, where we're looking at the concentration, in this case benzene, in a well over time. One kind of useful thing to remember is that you should always indicate whether there's detects or non-detects, and it's nice to have a different symbol for those. Because in some cases, you know, your detection limit can be changing, and that can, you know, kind of confuse your analysis. So here we see these detection limits are decreasing over time. So it doesn't really appear to be a real trend in the data. It's just a trend in the detection limits. All right, box plots are very useful for comparing two groups or more than two groups. And this is something we do a lot when we have, you know, we're doing like inter-well or intro-well testing where we have, say, example, a background set of wells and a compliance set of wells. And these box plots kind of provide various summaries of the data. So, for example, the line here in the middle is the median, kind of showing the central tendency of the data. And the top of the box is the 75th percentile, and the bottom of the box edge there is the 25th percentile. So that kind of shows the central portion of the data. And then we've got these things that are usually called whiskers that kind of show the range of the data, the exception of things that are, you know, potentially extreme values or outliers, which are actually tend to be plotted as individual data points. So just looking at these nice box plots, you can sort of see both the central tendency, the spread of the data, and then whether there's any outliers that should be investigated further. All right, another one is a scatter plot, and that's kind of used to look at the relationship between two different variables. So here we're showing arsenic concentrations versus mercury concentrations in one particular well. And, you know, we kind of see if we get a bunch of points that are on a line, then we sort of say there's a good linear correlation or relationship between these data points. So scatter plots are good for examining that kind of relationship. All right, so moving along to the next part of our approach here, we're kind of designing the statistical sampling plan. You know, best is to think about this prior to sampling, where you still have some control over the number of samples and locations of the samples that will be taken. And the point is to think about those decision errors and to control them, to collect enough samples in the right places so that you have acceptable levels of decision errors, both the false positive and the false negative errors. And the other time that you might want to do this planning is after you've gotten the sampling, you need to do an analysis to look at the statistical power that you've actually been able to achieve with your data to make sure that it is adequate. The way I kind of like to think about it is there's sort of some design trade-offs between these different elements here, where you've got the sample size. You know, usually you have some control over this, and it helps you control both the power, which is the false negative errors associated with the false negative errors, and the significance level, which is associated with the false positive errors. And the other thing that you can kind of think about controlling is what's called here the effect size, which is like the difference in, say, concentration that you think is significant between the two different groups. So if two, you know, if the background and the site wells are really only different on average in, you know, like 0.001 micrograms per liter, well, that's probably not really an important difference to be able to distinguish. So you can kind of think about that as you're designing the statistical decision program. All right, and then once you've got your data and you've kind of decided what you're going to do with it, you move on to actually evaluating that statistical evidence. So there's different approaches to doing this, and one of the more common ones is using hypothesis testing. And this approach is quite similar, parallel to that court case example, where you kind of go in with a null hypothesis, which is your assumption going into it before you've looked at the data, which would be like the not guilty assumption for a court case. And if you have enough evidence, then you can kind of reject that null hypothesis and accept an alternative hypothesis, which is just the sort of opposite of the null hypothesis, the converse of it. So that's sort of like, you know, whether there's enough data to help you, you know, to allow you to reject that null hypothesis is the point of the hypothesis testing. Now, what you choose as a hypothesis, the null hypothesis, sort of depends on what you're up to. So for example, if you're thinking about, do the site concentrations exceed background, then the null hypothesis would be that, you know, the site concentrations are consistent with background. So it's interesting thinking about the null hypothesis. You often just sort of pick the opposite of what you're really interested in. So for another example is if you're interested in whether the cleanup goals have been achieved, you know, then the null hypothesis is that you assume that the concentrations are above those cleanup goals. And you look to see whether there's enough evidence that the site's been cleaned up to allow you to disprove that. And then finally, if you're interested in whether there's a trend in the concentrations, the null hypothesis could be that there is no trend, that the slope in the concentrations is no different than zero. Okay, so just a few more details about how you go about doing the hypothesis testing. After you've sort of taken that first step of defining your hypotheses, then you use your computer software to help you calculate a test statistics. Obviously you have to pick which test is appropriate, and that also, of course, depends on what you're trying to get at. But for example, there's a t-test, which would be a sort of standard test that many people have heard of. So the test statistics is the t-statistic. And your software will compute the value of that statistics under the assumption that the null hypothesis is true. And then it'll also kind of give you a probability, that data or that t-statistic could have occurred, you know, under this assumption that the null hypothesis is true. And that probability is called the p-value. And we often just kind of focus in on the p-value and not the test statistic itself. And we look at the p-value, and if the p-value is small enough, then we'll reject the null hypothesis. So we see whether the p-value is less than the significance level of our test, which we just picked. So if we pick a significance level of 5%, then we see if the p-value is less than 5%, which means that the data would be very unlikely to occur under the assumption that the null hypothesis is true. So if the p-value is bigger than that significance level, then we can't reject the null hypothesis, and then we might want to look at the power of the test to see whether we really had adequate data to make that distinction. So just to go over the meaning of the p-values a little bit more, you know, all these p-values in test statistics, they measure the discrepancy between what you actually saw in the data and what you would expect to see if that null hypothesis was true. And what's that helping us to do is to sort of distinguish between the signal in our data and distinguish that from just natural variability. So if our p-value is small enough, then it's kind of measuring the strength of the evidence against the null hypothesis, kind of helping us distinguish between just natural variation and an actual signal that means something. So the lower p-values represent stronger evidence because it's less likely that that null hypothesis could be true. All right, so that's the hypothesis testing. We can also take some other approaches to looking at data and describing uncertainty. So often we want to look at the mean concentrations at a site. So for example, we might find a mean concentration of 5.1 milligrams per liter. We want to think about, well, how reliable is this estimate? And the kind of typical way of doing that is to use statistical intervals or kind of error bars to show how much confidence we have in that estimate of the mean, for example. There's different kinds of statistical intervals. And confidence intervals are the ones that probably everyone's heard of. These are sort of standard error bars that you might put on your means that you see. But there are other kinds, prediction intervals, which we'll talk about a bit more, and tolerance intervals, which are intervals on different types of things, so not necessarily a means, but other things. So all of these intervals, though, have a particular confidence level associated with them. So, for example, there might be 95% confidence level. So that would mean that that's the probability that that interval includes the value of interest. So if we're talking about the mean concentration and we have some confidence levels on that, then, if they're 95% confidence levels, then we're about 95% sure that we expect to see the true mean concentration within those intervals. And the other nice thing about confidence intervals is that we can actually use them to do hypothesis testing in a similar way that we just talked about. All right, so just wanted to point out, a little bit more about the difference between confidence intervals and prediction intervals, because prediction intervals actually are used in groundwater data evaluations, particularly for like RCRA regulations encourage their use. So as I said, confidence intervals show the uncertainty in statistics that we've actually calculated from our data, like the means or medians or slopes of regression lines. Whereas the prediction intervals are kind of more looking towards the future and thinking about, well, if we collected some additional samples, what range would we expect those additional samples to fall in? So here's a particular example of that. So we've got some data. Here's actual data points of total organic carbon. And, we can calculate the mean and then look at the confidence interval on that mean. So we've got an upper confidence limit and a lower confidence limit. But then if we think about what would happen if we collected one additional sample, then we would expect a much wider range of possibility. So that would be the prediction interval. So it's sort of a little bit wider than the existing data we have because it could be a little bit outside of that existing framework. So the confidence interval is kind of giving us an assessment of, where the true mean would be. And the prediction interval is kind of gives us a prediction of how where the range of an additional future sample would fall into. All right, so you go through a little examples of how you might use these in different phases of the life cycle. So if we think about the release detection or site characterization phase first, you kind of go in assuming that the site is clean, unless proven otherwise. So that would mean our null hypothesis could be, for example, that the mean concentration at the site is less than or equal to our maximum contaminant level, or MCL, which would be our regulatory limit in groundwater. Then the alternative hypothesis would just be the converse of that, that the mean is greater than the MCL. So if we get our data and we collect and calculate the mean, and then we could calculate the lower confidence limit on that mean, and we can do a hypothesis test, kind of like a hypothesis test, and reject the null hypothesis if that lower confidence limit is actually greater than the MCL. So the lower confidence limit kind of represents a kind of the lowest level that we might expect the mean to be, taking into account the uncertainty in the data. And if that lower limit is greater than the MCL, then we can be pretty sure that, you know, the null hypothesis should be rejected, and the site actually does have some impacts that need to be addressed. All right, so now this can all be, that can be contrasted with, if we're in the kind of other phase of the life cycle, a corrective action or remediation phase, where we know the site's contaminated. And what we're trying to figure out is, you know, has it been cleaned up? Have we done enough remediation? So here, then, the hypothesis would be reversed. So our null hypothesis is that the mean concentrations measured at the site are actually greater than the MCL. And then the alternative is the converse of that. So if we want to test that null hypothesis, we can look at the upper confidence limit on the mean. And if that upper confidence limit is less than the MCL, then we can be pretty sure that the null hypothesis should be rejected, and that we can conclude that the site, has, with some good confidence, reached the cleanup goals. All right, so that's looking at the evaluation of our data. And then after we do that, we want to kind of make sure we test the assumptions of our whatever statistical approaches we've used. And many of the methods depend on the fact that there's not any outliers in our data. And sometimes we get outliers. We get outliers for different regions. But here's a good example where we have an outlier in the concentration. It's a non-detect. It's just this one point has a very high detection limit that was elevated for some reason related to the, you know, the analytical method used in the lab. So sometimes things like this can cause problems for our statistical methods. So, you know, we should look into outliers like this, make sure it's not just a typo or something that can just be fixed. But if it's, you know, legitimate, we don't want to throw it out. But often what we can do is do the analysis both with and without the outlier and see if it makes a significant difference. And if it does, then we might need to do some further work, even extending to collecting additional data. Another typical assumption that you might need to check is whether your data follow a particular standard statistical distribution. And the ones we generally use in groundwater analysis are the normal distribution, log normal, and the gamma distributions. So if your data do follow these standard distributions, then we can use what are called parametric methods. And these are just methods that rely on that assumption. If your data don't follow, though, one of these distributions, you can still use non-parametric methods, which generally work, about the same way, about as well, but maybe don't give you quite the same level of power in some cases as the parametric methods. So how do you test distributions? Usually you can just do it graphically. So you can use, for example, a histogram. And here we're showing a histogram, and we can kind of see that it's generally following a bell-shaped curve. So we can conclude from this that the data are generally normally distributed. More specialized plot would be these probability plots, which kind of make it a little easier to test the assumption. Because if you plot your data and the data kind of follow a line like this on this sort of specialized plot, then you kind of say, all right, it's following a normal distribution, as you can see here in this example. All right, and finally, some other assumptions that you may have to look at are spatial or temporal independence. You know, we often assume that our samples are statistically independent. And it's important to think about that. So, for example, if you took one sample from a well and then you took another sample the next day, you know, those would be pretty much sampling the same or measuring the same thing. So they wouldn't be considered statistically independent, and it wouldn't be appropriate to count those as two separate samples. So that's often why we have rules about doing quarterly sampling, things like that, so we don't sample so close together that our samples aren't statistically independent. And, of course, the same thing applies to spatial. You know, you don't want to sample too close together because those wouldn't really be independent either. So, and of course, anything that would be a duplicate or a replicate wouldn't be considered dependent, so you wouldn't be able to count those as separate samples. Other things you have to think about are trends in the background. Often you need to assume that the background is stable, i.e. it doesn't have a trend in it. You kind of generally want to look at that graphically as well. So here's a case where you see a trend in the background concentrations that you'd want to address. In some cases by either removing that trend or just using a particular time period that didn't have a trend. All right, so finally, just to summarize some of the things we've reviewed in this section, it's very useful to plot your data as part of your exploratory data analysis. It's important to think about appropriate error rates, both false positive and false negative error rates, in order to help you decide whether you really have sufficient data to make a good decision, one that has low enough error rates. It's important to look at the regulatory requirements for your particular situation because the state requirements can be quite different and different requirements depending on what program you're in. So you really want to look at those closely. And generally, very good idea to combine the statistical analysis with other lines of evidence. You really want to make sure that your statistical conclusions make sense in terms of, you know, hydrogeology and things like that that are also important. And so finally here, a little quote related to that. If you've tortured the data long enough, it will confess to anything. And that's just kind of a reminder that, you know, we really do need to look at these other lines of evidence and not just depend on some very close, you know, trying all kinds of different statistical approaches until you get the one that gives you the answer you want. So, all right, so that's it for that section. And next we're going to have a little question and answer break.
Thanks, Chris. We do now have time for questions and answers. For those of you on the phone line, if you'd like to ask your question out loud in just a moment, I'll give you an opportunity to do that. And just remember, it is #6 to unmute. At any time, anyone can submit questions in the Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. So if you have a question, you can go ahead and do that at any time. Just a reminder for those of you who do need documentation of continuing education credits by participating in ITRC online training, you can get a certificate of participation by completing the feedback form at the conclusion of today's class. Once you fill out that form, there's a button for you to click at the bottom of that feedback form to certify you participated today. Once you do that, a certificate of participation will be generated for you. I'm going to pull up a poll question as we are doing our first question answer period. It says, select the area where you use statistics on your projects, and you can select all that apply in this one. If you can't quite see all the choices, there should be a scroll bar over on the right-hand side or on the bottom, which allows you to scroll up and down and right or left. Let's go to our phone lines now. If you have a question for our trainers, please go ahead and speak up now. Oh, All right, we'll go ahead and go to some of our written questions. And Chris, I think this first one came in about the time that you were talking about the null hypothesis and going through that example. And bear with me just a second here. Okay, this person says that they had been reviewing some other regulatory type guidance for background studies from 2002 and 2007. And from what they were finding, it looks like they said that there's a need to define the null hypothesis as site greater than background. So in other words, assuming guilty and then prove otherwise. And they're kind of questioning that and says it seems like there's technical issues with that. And wanted to know if you could comment on that.
Yeah. Well, it is a good point. I mean, there are definitely different regulatory requirements, and it's good that you're looking at those carefully. So, it makes a big difference how you define the null hypothesis. I guess I would say normally, you're interested in whether the site has a greater concentration than background. And so you would tend to define your null hypothesis as sort of the opposite of that, which is that the site is, equal to or even less than background. And you would look at whether there's enough data to disprove that. So I would say it's hard to show... It would be hard to show that your site is, less than background, because that would be, pretty much impossible. I would say that that is a tricky situation of trying to set up the hypothesis as you've described it. So, I guess I would just look at that a little bit further to make sure that's really, the way it is, and. And hopefully you can figure out something that make a little more sense.
Okay, this next question says, what methods are there for dealing with results from duplicate samples?
Yeah, I mean, there's no, I think, hard and fast rule about what you do with duplicate samples. I guess, statistically speaking, probably the best thing to do would be to average them and then treat them as one sample, treat the average as one sample. But I think requirements do vary on this, and I think some people might actually take the maximum of the two or things like that. In some cases, I've worked on projects where the advice was just to ignore the duplicate sample with the argument that you're really collecting the duplicates to help you assess the variability in the data, but then when you're actually doing the data analysis, you don't need to use the duplicate, so you would just throw it out and not use it, just use the primary sample. So those are some examples of ways of handling it. I don't think there's a really hard and fast rule about which one's best.
Right, this person says that they have annual nitrate data since 1997, and they're wondering if they can run Mann-Kendall trend analysis on that type of data.
Well, sure. Yeah, I don't see any reason you can't Mann-Kendall. You're selecting a non-parametric approach. So... That would work independent of what the distribution of the data was. So that seems like that would be a reasonable thing to do.
Right. Next question says, would you normally include outlier data points in the calculation of the mean?
Yeah. I mean, this is a good question, and again, there's really no hard and fast rule about it. Very much depends on why the data is an outlier. In some cases it's an outlier because it's really just wrong and that somebody wrote down the wrong number, and that's something that you can go back and fix. Some cases it might be related to analytical issues that the lab has had, in which case you're not really sure whether it's correct or not. And, you know, you might try and do things both with and without the outlier. And if you find that it makes a big difference whether you include it or not, then you might actually need to collect some additional data to kind of fill in that data gap. But if you find that you can kind of just include the outlier in your analysis and you still kind of get the same conclusion, then, you know, you can kind of safely not really worry about it.
Right. This next question has to do with background groundwater data. It says, what about background groundwater data in statistics? This will have a large effect on making remediation decisions, for example, if you have an area high in manganese.
Yeah, no, certainly for where you're concerned with contaminants that are naturally occurring, like metals, for example, you know, the evaluation of background is very critical. So, of course, it's important to pick an appropriate background data set, and that's obviously something that takes a little bit of care to make sure you've selected points that are going to be, you know, representative of background and not influenced by any site activities. Once you have a very, you know, robust background data set, then you can kind of go to the next step and begin comparing that to data from that's associated with the site. So I kind of find generally people sometimes just don't have enough background data, and it makes it difficult to make conclusions that you can have that much confidence in. Because if you only have a few samples, then you know, you kind of limits the degree of confidence that you can have in your statistical results.
Okay, what is the best test to evaluate seasonal variability in data from a single well?
I don't know that I would say there's a best test, but essentially, you know, generally you kind of have, you can either take a parametric test approach or a non-parametric approach, and there's just kind of different ways of doing it. None of them are definitely best. One way of doing it is if you have annual variability, then you would, you kind of take all the samples from one quarter, combine them into one group, and then look at the samples from, you know, say another quarter, and sort of test to see whether those are, different from each other, or, you know, whether all the first quarter samples are the same, and then, you know, they're all significantly different than other quarters. I do believe there is a kind of example of looking at seasonality in data analysis in the online guidance document. So if you haven't looked at the online guidance, it's kind of a nice example of how to do that.
All right, let's go back to our phone line audience. Any questions for the trainers? All right, we'll go back to some written questions. It says, please elaborate on how statistics may affect your sampling plans.
Yeah, well, so basically it affects, in the most basic level, you know, how many samples you might want to collect. So if you follow, you know, either the, you know, online guidance, and I guess I should have also mentioned that EPA has some good guidance as part of their data quality objectives series of guidance documents. It talks about this. But you're basically trying to figure out, well, if I want to be, have a certain confidence in my conclusion, how many samples do I need, you know, given some assumptions about the variability in the data? So that's kind of the fundamental question is, you kind of think about what you need and then make sure you get enough data to support that level of confidence.
All right, we do need to move on to the second portion of the presentation. We'll do our best to get to as many questions in the second Q&A as well. Also, we would like our trainers for those questions that we didn't get answered to go ahead and respond privately in writing back to those people asking the questions. So we'll do our best to respond to all of you as time allows. So let's go ahead and move now over to slide 44, and I'll turn it over to Lizanne Simmons with Kleinfelder. Lizanne?
Thanks, Mary. We're now going to present some different examples of the application of statistics to groundwater sites. So in the next few sections, we're going to go through some study question applications and use the project life cycle to highlight the concepts and statistical methods that Harold and Chris have just presented. And these could apply to some typical questions that you may want to ask. Because of the time involved, we won't be able to cover all the questions in the training, but we'll kind of give you a flavor of what's in the guidance document. If you want to get further into discussions of all the study questions, they're found in Appendix C of the document. Since groundwater statistical methods have applications throughout the life cycle of environmental projects, we're going to use the project life cycle stages and study questions to illustrate the connections to some hypothetical sites. These questions were developed by the team so that you can easily navigate through typical issues and questions that may come up during various phases associated with groundwater monitoring and also ways to evaluate the data. If you look at the table on the left, we show the project life cycle and stages, this time as columns, and the study questions are listed at the right. The study questions that generally apply to each of the life cycle stages are known are shown with the X's in the table on the left. In the guidance document, this is the main tool we use to connect between life cycle stages and study questions, and it's used to help the reader find information that's relevant to their particular site. The first concept we're going to discuss is background. And for background study questions, 1 and 2 are applicable. For study question 1, what are background concentrations? Applies to life cycle stages for release detection, site characterization, and closure. For study question 2, are concentrations above background? Applies to release detection, site characterization, monitoring, and closure. So, what is background? There have been a couple of questions that have come up to this point. So we'll kind of discuss this a little bit. But sometimes the concept of background can vary from state to state, but what we're talking about here is site-related versus not site-related. In general, both native and man-made sources need to be taken into account. However, you've got to establish a baseline, because groundwater may already be tainted with concentrations of a contaminant from either native or man-made sources that would make it difficult, if not impossible, to clean up to what would be considered a pristine standard. The web-based guidance document addresses this in more detail, but let's just kind of go through a little bit of detail on this. So background is usually tied to some sort of a regulatory threshold, whether it's a criterion like an NCL, a risk-based criterion, or some other threshold. Now, if we go back in, I think it's slide 31, Chris discussed intra-well versus inter-well, and consider this as a time-only relationship versus a space-time relationship. For intra-well samples, you're sampling the same well many times so that you're looking at as essentially a before, if possible, a during, and an after contamination picture. Natural factors typically don't affect intra-well samples, only what happens over time. Inter-well samples, you're comparing different wells. And generally, you're comparing what you're considering as upgrading or background wells with downgraded compliance wells. So here you're evaluating samples over both time and space. So when we're evaluating background, what do we need to consider? Okay, first of all, known sources. How many sources are not related to site contamination that may be around there? Also distance and direction and geology, hydrogeology information. For example, estimated groundwater direction, if you've got a fracture flow, and then, you know, of course, evaluation of intra-well versus inter-well data. You need to look also at multiple aquifer characteristics. For example, do you have a perch zones or zones? multiple aquifers, and if so, you're not going to want to cross-contaminate. So you need to be aware of that. Also, you need to look at your data quality objectives. We talked a little bit about this before. And your data quality objectives should be developed up front because a couple of things. Number one, you need sufficient samples to provide reliable results. But you also need to take a look at the quality of your data set. For example, you know, if you've got things over a period of time or if you've used different labs, you may have multiple detection limits. So basically what it comes down to is you need to develop a good conceptual site model to maximize the validity of your assumptions. As Chris talked about in the previous segment, we should use exploratory data analysis methods to help evaluate a potential background set. And this is discussed in detail in sections 333 and 3.5. An initial step would simply be to inspect the data to determine the frequency of detection, representativeness of samples, whether there's one or more detection limits, the time span of the data. For example, can some of the data be too old? And the consistency of analytical methods. For example, if you've got BTEX, you may have analysis over time that have been run by EPA methods 80-20, 80-21, or 80-260. So you need to take this into account as well. To get a quick visual, you should probably use graphical methods such as histograms, quartile plots, box plots, scatter plots, to plot the data set to provide some sort of insight into you know, what would be the overall spread and potential distribution of the data. You then need to determine the distribution of the data set to figure out whether it's parametric, for example, whether it's normal or log normal, or non-parametric, where it may not necessarily fit a normal distribution or you may not have enough samples. And also which statistical methods will be needed when you try to evaluate your background. For example, a t-test, which is the parametric method, is sensitive to outliers. All right, so let's move into an example here. So most regulatory governance, for example, RCRA, requires some sort of establishment of background. And the example that we've got here shows how potential background well data can be evaluated to determine whether a data set can be used to characterize background. So this example applies to study question one, what are background concentrations? And also to study question two, are the concentrations greater than background concentrations? And as I go through this, for study question one, we'll use descriptive statistics. And for study question two, we'll use some inferential hypotheses. This example shows a hypothetical metal recycling facility. And arsenic's the primary chemical concern. And you need to note that the groundwater plume has already been characterized. So for this site, the conceptual site model has been completed and validated. Hydrogeology has been studied. And based on hydrogeology, these are the upgradient wells, which are wells, numbers 1 and 2, the ones in the red. The side gradient wells, which are wells 7 and 8. And the downgradient wells, which are wells 3, 6, 5, and 4. And this is all based on the conceptual site model. The objective, when we're looking at this, is to identify the data set that would be consistent with background. So we first need to select a potential data set from our data and evaluate the quality, the shape, the distribution of the data set. What are the data quality objectives and how do they apply to the number of samples required? Are there non-detects that must be addressed? Does the data have a stable mean and a variance or are there some sort of trends? Are there outliers? And also take a look at what's the distribution. So what we got here is we selected a data set for the two hydrogeologically upgradient wells, which are wells 1 and 2, over a 2-year period. For our purposes, this should give us a sufficient number of samples to meet our data quality objectives. And in this particular data set, you can note that there's no non-detects. This is metals. And both upgradient wells are also below the MCF. So with that data set, then we can start moving things around here. So there's a number of methods and tools to do preliminary statistical analysis. For example, you can use probability plots or time series plots. And for interpretation of results, as things plot up, you need to understand the source of the variation, whether it's natural or man-made. You need to understand the environmental setting that it's associated with. And, you know, you need to also get whatever information or research you can do from published studies. You need to take a look at temporal changes. For example, a rainy season versus dry season. We talked a little bit about that. And I think Randall's going to talk about that in the next section as well. And you also need to take a look at the presence of outliers, because if you look at these particular plots here, you can see some outliers. Then, based on your analysis interpretation, does your conceptual site model need to be revised? And just remember, conceptual site models are living documents, so if there appears to be another upgradient source, update your conceptual site model. In this case, based on the graphical methods that we've used, W1 appears to be fairly consistent with that expected for a background well, where W2 has a couple of points or outliers that may be called into question. Upon further research, we decided that these two points both occur in April when there's larger runoff from the mountains where there are higher arsenic concentrations in the rocks. Therefore, these both can be considered background wells. More often when you look at things, the specific reason for an outlier isn't known, and this is where your statistical methods come in handy in being able to manage that outlier data. So now we're going to start talking about compliance a little bit, specifically monitoring compliance. And go forward. There we go. For monitoring compliance, we move to study questions 3 and 4. For study question 3, are concentrations above or below a criterion applies to life cycle stages for release detection, site characterization, remediation, monitoring, and closure. For study question 4, when will that criterion be met, applies to project life cycle stages for remediation, monitoring, and closure. Because of the time constraints that we've got here, we're not going to address study question 4 today in this internet-based training, but it is discussed in more detail in the guidance document. Why do we do monitoring and compliance? Well, we do monitoring primarily to evaluate site characteristics. And site characteristics can be evaluated based on a combination of both spatial and temporal data. For monitoring design, you need to take a look at, what are your chemical constituents over time? And what are your contaminants? For example, if you're looking at chlorinated hydrocarbons, you might have, PCE, TCE, and vinyl chloride. Where are you in that, series there? So you need to also identify a release with monitoring design. This helps you develop a conceptual site model. And it's also for compliance with regulatory requirements. And, sometimes this is, one of the more important things, to evaluate the chemical concentrations for compliance with groundwater protection criteria. And if we're looking at the basis for monitoring compliance for groundwater criteria compliance, it can be an MCL, some sort of risk-based value, based on an exposure scenario. It can be an eco-protection value. It can be whatever you consider background. And compliance measures should be presented in your quality assurance project plan. For example, the number of samples that you need. The distribution you need to look at, for example, whether it's parametric, normal or log normal, versus non-parametric where it doesn't fit normal distribution, or there's not enough samples. What is your regulatory threshold? And this can vary depending on what compliance criteria you're addressing. And also the compliance point. This could be a specific number, it could be a maximum limit, or even a set value or something that you've calculated. So for a monitoring compliance example, we're going to focus on study question 3, are concentrations above or below a criterion? So once again, we're looking at our hypothetical metal recycling facility, and we've already determined that wells 1 and 2 are upgradient wells. Wells 7 and 8, based on our conceptual site model, are side gradient. And remember, 1 and 2 are background as well as upgradient. And these wells are all outside the plume. So wells 1, 2, 7, and 8 are all outside the plume. So for this question, we're going to focus on wells W3, 4, 5, and 6, which I've got in red here, and are either within the plume or directly downgrading of the suspected source. Here's our data set for wells W3 through W6. It's got the same number of samples and date ranges as we saw for wells W1 and 2, and it also meets our DQO, so this is over a 2-year period. Now there's, once again, no non-detects in this data set because it's metal. But also take a note as you look at this that the data set presented above mimics an actual laboratory data set where higher concentrations tend to have fewer significant figures based on threshold detection limits. So based on a conceptual site model, well, Well, W3 is closest to the source. Well, W4, which is to the right, is farther down gradient. And wells W5 and W6 are our intermediate wells, which are between the source and down gradient of the plume. So what we've got here, let's take a look at wells W3 and W6. And the first thing you may notice here is the samples from these two wells are 6 to 9 times the MCL. Samples from well W6 are about twice the MCL, and there's also less variation in the data. These are all in the 20s. Then you see with well W3, which, you know, can vary, 30 plus points. So we're now going to take a look at wells W5 and W4. And one of the first things you see is that looking at well W4, the samples are all below the MCL and are fairly consistent, while the samples from W5 are, have a slightly larger spread and straddle both sides of the MCL. Now for W3 and W4 and W6, just, kind of looking at these, you may not need statistics. But that may be true, but it's also a misconception. There's always uncertainty in the results. And the real usefulness here are in the sample results for W5, which is the harder case. Okay, so here's, another set of plots that we've done up. And Chris previously discussed data distributions and confidence intervals in his segment. So as we're evaluating the data from these four wells in our example, we need to look at confidence intervals. And these are also discussed in detail in the guidance document. There's many kinds of confidence intervals, but they tend to bind a single population. The mean or average is a typical confidence measure, and the mean is shown here as the horizontal colored lines for the various well sample sets. So for example, the mean for the W3 sample set is in green, and it's this line over here, right here. And the mean for the W4 sample set is in blue down here. So, you know, the mean is based on multiple observations so that a decision can be made with statistical confidence. So, for example, one point doesn't prove the mean or the max is below a certain criterion, but also one point above doesn't violate that criterion. So now I want you to take a look at the vertical black arrows here. Okay, the vertical black arrows show the confidence interval on the mean for the different well sample sets. For example, the variability of the confidence interval on the green sample set is, you know, is fairly large, and it's greater than the confidence interval for the blue sample set here, which is a lot smaller. So confidence intervals can also be measured around things such as an upper percentile or a median, and the percentiles can vary too, depending on your risk tolerance. So for example, you know, typically what we look at is, you know, 90, 95, or 99% for typical values. The number of samples required to calculate a confidence interval for your site should be based on your data quality objectives. There should be a sufficient number of samples for to compensate for variability of data, uncertainty, false negatives, and also for false positives. All right, so we've got a couple of more graphs up. You know, we've calculated some of the 95% UCLs here. Now, this particular site happens to be in the state of Washington. And since it's in Washington, we must use the guidance that's been designated by the state. You need to remember that it should be noted that this is one method, and it doesn't match up with what's in the unified guidance, but this is what the particular state's chosen. In the guidance document, we talk a bit about regulatory barriers for the various states. And Harold's also mentioned this previously. So after we go through the Washington State guidance, we'll also do an example of this project as a reference site that uses the unified guidance. These two examples are given to kind of illustrate how the results of statistical analysis are used and how they're used in different ways by different regulatory agencies. And, you know, back to also what Chris said is that, you know, if you torture the data, not that it will confess to anything. But as we're looking at this, CLEAN will most likely be based upon state prescribed methods that may or may not be statistically based. In this example, the data from wells were evaluated using a state of Washington compliance test, which starts out with a comparison of the 95% UCL, which is, you know, what we have up here. Now, the state of Washington compliance test, in examples, the 95% UCL has, you know, two other criteria. So there's three altogether. So the first criteria is the upper 95% confidence interval on the mean less than the cleanup standard? So as we're looking at this, for wells, you know, 3, 6, and 5, that's no. And for well 4, that's a yes. The second criteria is, in the maximum data, is the maximum data point value less than twice the cleanup standard? And for wells W3 and W6, that's a no. And for wells W5 and W4, that is a yes. And the third criterion is, are 10% of the data above the cleanup standard? And for wells 3, 5, and 6, that answer is a yes. And for well 4, that is a no. So if we're looking at this based on the state of Washington compliance test, wells 3, 5, and 6 are not in compliance, and well 4 is in compliance. So the main question here is, you know, to look further beyond this, is if concentrations remain above the groundwater protection criterion, then when will that site be in compliance? And as I said, we're not addressing that today based on the time, but that's something that needs to be considered. So let's take a look at this in a different light. As referenced in our guidance document, when we're looking at the record situation, and this is based on 40 CFR 264.99, the US EPA's unified guidance document is typically used. So let's take a look at the same site based on that guidance. As Chris described earlier, from a release detection point of view, the MCL represents an average concentration and the appropriate statistical test is the null hypothesis, where the mean is less than the groundwater protection criterion. And this, the mean in this case is assumed to represent the true mean concentration. We conclude that a well is in compliance when the lower confidence limit of the mean is less than the groundwater protection criterion. In other words, because we don't know what the true mean is, we assume that it could be any value within the confidence interval that we've calculated. So even though the mean might be greater than the groundwater protection criterion, we're not out of compliance until the lower confidence limit is also greater than the mean. In this table here, we've calculated the 95% confidence interval for the mean of the concentrations for each well under the assumption that the data were normally distributed. To evaluate the distribution, you may also want to use some distributional tests, which are described in Section 5 of the online guidance. And this will help you figure out whether your data follows some sort of a distribution. Look at the assumptions in your test, because this can be important. When we compare the lower confidence limit to the arsenic MCL of 10 micrograms per liter, then when that's done, the lower confidence limit was greater than the MCL. We concluded that we're out of compliance, and vice versa when the lower confidence limit was less than the MCL. So in this example, wells W3 and W6 are out of compliance, and wells W4 and W5 are in compliance. So in this assumption, from a release detection perspective, the null hypothesis is that the well is in compliance. Now, if the groundwater protection criterion falls below the UCL, then the null hypothesis won't be rejected unless the groundwater protection criterion is also below the lower confidence limit. Just to be sure, background exceedances don't predetermine any relationship of those increases versus the groundwater protection criterion. Now, if you're looking from a remediation or corrective action point of view, then the null hypothesis is actually reversed. So again, I just kind of wanted to do this just to demonstrate the differences in the regulatory framework. So now I'm going to hand this over to Randall Wrighty of Neptune, and he'll discuss trend analysis and monitoring optimization. Randall?
Yeah, thank you, Liz. So in case you're following along in your own package, we're now on slide 65. And so for trend analysis, there is actually four study questions that have been identified in the web-based guidance document. And today we're going to cover three of these. The fourth one, question 8, has to do with changes with distance, which is a spatial trend analysis. And we're not going to cover that, but if you're interested in that topic, you can go to section 5.15 in the web-based guidance document. Well, just to kind of reiterate a topic, just something that you should do with your data is plot the data. So, a picture of the data is pretty informative. So this case, we're just illustrating, this is taken from the US EPA Unified Guidance document, and it's showing an example that they have in their document of concentrations over time. In this case, it's monthly measurements over about 3 years. And it's showing an increase in general, but there's some changes in concentration within each year. So we can see there might be some seasonality going on here. In this case, it's plotting all detected data, so that's another important thing. When you're creating a plot, if you have non-detects and detects, it's important to have different symbols for. In this case, we're using an open symbol to show these are detected data. Well, but plotting data is good, but actually doing the formal statistical analyses is a very important thing to do. In this case, we're just showing that there's a linear regression that you could fit to all these data, and this linear regression does help. It illustrates that there's now, you can see that there is an increasing trend over this period of time in this groundwater analyte concentration. Well, what are possible applications to trend analyses? And we've had some questions about background levels and discussion in the exploratory data analysis section that Chris was giving about getting ready to do statistics, and of course, Liz gave an example about background. But so one of the important things in background is actually evaluating whether or not the background concentrations, background levels are stable or not. So this could affect the validity of your analyses if background levels are actually changing, whether or not it's due to changing over between years or it's seasonal changes. And so it's just something to be aware of and evaluating your data. And this gets to the point in statistics that the assumptions of most every test is that your data are independent and identically distributed. It's known as IID. And so it gets to also the point about what Chris made of also about sampling frequencies. And we'll cover that a little bit more in the optimization section. But if you sample too often, obviously the data aren't independent. So there's some other applications for trend analyses and just the release detection. Are they increasing steadily? Compliance for monitored natural attenuation. Are concentrations going down? And is the monitored natural attenuation feasible or realistic over the period of time that you're concerned about? And optimization, we'll talk about that in a separate section coming up next. Well, this is something that comes up pretty frequently in groundwater data, and this also helps us illustrate one of the things we have in the web-based guidance document. So we have a study question, six, is there seasonality? And that study questions are in Appendix C. And another thing that we have in the guidance document is we actually have some examples. And so these are data that we have from the example in Appendix A. So this is Table A-2 in particular. And just to illustrate what we're showing here, so this plot over on this side is just showing the concentrations over time. And here we have, again, all detected data, but now we're showing symbols to show the different seasons, fall, spring, summer, and winter. And you can see that if you look at the fall concentrations, they tend to be the higher values up here. The other thing just to note is this is actually the log concentration. So this is plotted on a log scale, concentration data. And then we can show the data in a different way. So that's what this other plot on this other panel here is showing the data. So there's, again, the fall data. You can see that the data have higher concentrations. And the spring is showing the lowest concentration in this example we constructed. Well, if we're actually doing a seasonality analysis, what we're doing is, if you're familiar with analysis of variance, that's the kind we're showing with the different data groups, the different seasons. So we're showing that the data are fairly consistent within a season and they differ between seasons, we can actually adjust the data for seasonality. So in this case, I've highlighted a particular point right here. And what you do is you look at the value of that point and you compare it to that season mean, so that's that point. And now we come up with that value there, that's the difference between the two, and that is a positive 0.3. We'll just show another example, and then actually I forgot the rest of it. So you're going to take that value, 0.3, positive 0.3, and you're looking at then the overall mean. And so basically the adjusted value is going to be about 1.2, because you have a value about 0.2, 0.3 above this value, 0.9. Now here's another example. This value down here is what we're looking at, a low value in spring. So and there's the comparison, and it's a negative 0.2. is the value, So again, you're going to compare a negative, you're going to take and adjust negative 0.2 to this overall mean, and you get about negative 0.74. So that's how you take each, and then you go through each of the values that we have on this plot, and you're taking the original data, and now you can construct a new plot of the data. And so if the data are on the same scale as before, you can see that here, but now we've removed the seasonality in these data. So it's been, in essence, sort of de-seasonalized, detrended with that. And what happens, actually, is that looks from appearances, you can say, yeah, that looks like a more tight relationship. And if you remember from the previous slide, that we compare the R-squared. The R-square is the fit of the model. So on the previous model, it was, you know, 0.05 roughly. So people also look at that as percentage explained variance. So that's divided by 100. You say it's 5%. This one up here is when we take the seasonality out, we now have about a third. So we can explain a third of the variance. So we have improved relationship, and just kind of now this is more of a diagnostic. If we look at the seasonality, we can confirm that, yeah, we removed the seasonality in this plot by that method I just described. Well, what about another example with looking at trends? And so this is an example that's relating to interpolating, basically, within a trend time frame. So this is an example of concentrations, in this case of TCE, over about a 2.5-year period of time. And so the actual data are these solid symbols, and they're just connected together here to show an overall relation trend over time with that method. So we fit something to this, and it's this teal thin line, which is this line here. And that's a non-parametric method. And we're just also showing for comparison purposes, here's the cleanup goal. And so there's different ways of looking at time series data. So you're going to say, well, we did have the first sampling event highlighted here. That first sampling event is below the line. But you might wonder about the confidence in that being below the line. And that's why you can then look at, you know, what's the first time period, in this case is within this range, where we've illustrated that the upper confidence bound on this. So again, we're looking at now the upper confidence bound because we had concentrations above, and now we're trying to determine, you know, what's the first time period when they're going to be below. And that's this period here. And so this is within a time period you're interpolating the relationship that we're seeing there. And that's a useful method to have, and it gives you a statistical method for saying there's confidence, greater than 90% confidence, that we've met the cleanup goal, in this case for TCE. But a more important comparison we might be doing is looking at projecting out in the future. And so when we're projecting out in the future, this is extrapolating. We're extrapolating from what we've measured, and we're going to look at into the future. And so if we think about, you know, models we're familiar with from, you know, like the Weather Service has hurricane forecast models. If you look at hurricane forecast models, what's typical about those is you look at out in the future, as you go out consecutive days, the width, you know, potential location will be wider. There's more uncertainty as we're going out into the future. And conceptually, you think, yeah, that should be the same case with projecting concentrations. We have a model for concentration. In this case, we have data set. So it's, again, the same data we were looking at before. And it's a log scale. Now we're plotting it on the original units here. But it's a log scale of data. We have about 12 years of data over this example we have in the Appendix A. And looking into the future now. So what's important is actually when you're thinking about the model, so the model is primarily the slope we've estimated. And so we show here the best estimate of the slope is this line here. The blue line is the best estimate of the slope. But that slope could be, you know, shallower, which means the concentrations really are going to be decreasing less over time than we might expect. Or it could be a steeper slope, in which case we're more along this line. And so what this is showing us is that the confidence limits are really on this slope. And so as we look at a shallow slope, It might be this point up here, which case is, you know, over at past the end of our plot here, so somewhere around 2080. We'll be looking at this goal here, achieving that goal, versus this more optimistic view of the slope. It could be as early as 2020. So those are the two points that you'll come up with this method. But this is important to distinguish between when we're doing extrapolating, we're projecting future concentrations versus interpolating. Okay, well, let's go to the last topical area here, and it's going to be monitoring optimization. And there's a couple of study questions that we have. So a study question has to do with sampling frequency, and basically, is the sampling frequency adequate for the purposes? And basically, going back to our study objectives and DQOs. And the other question has to do with spatial coverage, which for groundwater monitoring primarily has to do with the number of wells. It might also have to do with the intervals we're screening to if we have multiple aquifers that we're characterizing. Well, optimization is basically our objective is to have efficient data collecting the right amount of data for making decisions. One might argue that you can collecting more data will always lead to maybe improved decisions and less uncertainty. But there's usually kind of a point of diminishing returns where collecting more data really doesn't give you any more information and basically could start violating some of the assumptions of your statistical tests if your data are no longer independent. So that's why we look at optimization and try to find out what, you know, what's efficient or not for your particular study. And then the other way of looking at this is that there's little statistical correlation or redundancy in the data. And again, you have adequate data for making accurate decisions. And it gets back to what Chris was talking about in terms of your, you know, your false positive and false negative error rates. And the other thing I'll note here is that we have another team, and Mary mentioned it at the beginning that there's a geostatistics for remediation optimization, and there's some of the same instructors involved in teaching that class as are teaching today. And I'd recommend that if you're interested in some more information on tools related to optimization and spatial analysis of data. And the other thing that's really important for optimization is that optimization is not strictly just a statistical exercise. You have to remember and use your conceptual site model. Like I alluded to, there could be multiple aquifers you're interested in characterizing. There's things that are important like boundary effects. You might have a river that's a boundary of your site, and that can lead to an edge effect, and you have to incorporate that into your conceptual site model and your statistical analysis of your data. Well, let's talk about temporal optimization for a little bit. So a temporal optimization is to look at getting an optimal frequency interval of sampling. And again, and Chris touched on this, I think, a little bit too. Question came about sampling frequencies. So if you sample and you sample the next day, you're basically sampling the same groundwater. And it's a matter of, well, how fast is the groundwater moving and mixing, and that's leading to potentially different conditions at your site. So that functionally gives you what the, you know, where things become not redundant. And then in statistical terms, this is autocorrelation, that one event is very correlated to the next one. And even going back to the seasonality question, you know, we could have one season being fairly correlated to the past year's season. So these are things we have to be aware of as we're trying to optimize sampling frequencies. And starting point for a lot of sites is monthly or quarterly sampling, depending upon your regulatory environment and budget oftentimes. But you can look at the actual data once you have some, and then you can do this method, which we're saying is a strategy you can adjust the frequency to minimize correlation while still capturing whatever trends you have and concentrations in groundwater. Well, let's look at a couple different example methods. So this is, again, example A.4, Appendix A. So it's hypothetical data. And in this case, we're using a particular software package called Visual Sampling Plan. And this is just a screenshot of part of the analysis that was done using VSP. And so in this case, what VSP is plotting is these dark filled symbols. I'm kind of scanning over here. Those are the actual sample results. And then what it's done is it's interpolated and fit these data with now these filled red circles. And that's the fitted data. And then the other thing that it's showing on here is a 90% confidence interval. So the reason why it's showing this particular information is because when you're looking at this kind of method, iterative thinning, you have kind of a model that you're fitting to your data. And you're looking at basically as if I had conceptually say, well, what if I had half as much data? So I had, instead of quarterly sampling, I had semi-annual sampling. Well, what kind of model would I fit with those data when I take half of it out? And so you have to have a confidence interval that you're trying to achieve meet that. I want to meet that 90% of the time, 99% of the time. And so that's the relevance of the confidence interval. And in this particular example, the software gave a solution of 227 days, which you would round off to once every 6 months for sampling. And that would basically still capture this trend. And there's a couple of reasons I presented this particular example, because the other thing that I mentioned is if you're looking at the model and how well you can subset the data and still capture the model, well, there's actually some data, and I'll circle them down here, that are below this model. And that's something to be aware of, is if you're fitting the data to a model, then there may be a lack of fit to some of the data. And the question becomes, using, in essence, kind of outliers amongst this overall trend. What's the reason for this trend? Are we concerned about, a lack of fit at these particular points? In this case, since they're below the model, they may not be as much concerned. If there were a lack of fit and they were on the other side of this graph, you might be very concerned about not capturing those data within your model. So it's just something to be aware of when you're doing some of these analyses, because you're taking the raw data and you're fitting a model to the data. Well, here's another approach for looking at temporal optimization. And this method is out of the Meros software, which is the monitoring and remediation optimization system software. And for this particular method, what you do is you do some statistical analyses on your data. So let's start going across the top, which is relating to the rate of change. And rate of change is obtained by doing a linear regression of particular well. And so this is kind of well by well approach with this particular chart method. So we have a particular well, and we looked at the trend, and we have high, medium, and low. And then high is relative to the standard MCL that we're looking at. So high would be a rate of change of 2 times. Low is less than half. Medium is in between. So that's how you characterize a well into this part of the chart. The other part of the chart is whether or not the trend is increasing, that's I, or decreasing, D. And this is done using a non-parametric method, the Mann-Kendall trend analysis. So we can see that most of the difference occurs relative to the rate of change with this method. So high, and it's now we're looking at the chart here, it's Q for quarterly and A for semi-annual, the difference between the high and the low. And there is some difference between if you have an increasing trend with a high rate of change or high to medium high, then it's going to recommend more quarterly sampling. And then you, vice versa, if it's a decreasing trend, you may wind up being in this annual method. And this is a method that's fairly simple to use, although it can be laborious if you have a lot of wells, because it's a well-by-well kind of method. Okay, what about spatial optimization? Spatial optimization is, again, sort of looking at the number and placement of well locations. And again, we're interested in whether or not some wells might be redundant. If we have a lot of data for a particular site, we can look and say, well, we're getting really the same result for wells A, B, and C, can we just pick well B to represent this area? And then the more difficult question sometimes is if we have uncertainty in our plume map, where should we add wells and how many should we be adding these wells? Well, conceptually, it's relatively simple. I mean, if you have a large data set, large number of wells, you can say, well, I can remove these wells, and you can even imagine doing this by hand. Take the data set and remove a set of wells. What happens to certain parts of certain estimates, like the mass of the contaminant in the plume or trends over space and time? And then the more difficult thing can be dealing with the uncertainty where you have few wells. Well, just to give a little bit of background on some of the methods, so as I've kind of alluded to already, one method is what we call a qualitative evaluation. So if you have a relatively small site, it's feasible to go ahead and remove wells manually and see what happens to your plume maps. You can't really add wells conceptually with that method. And so that's where you get into some other tools. The creating uncertainty is a geospatial tool, so you can basically estimate that. And then there's some other methods at the top that's mentioning genetic algorithms, which have nothing to do with biology, but are a computer programming method. And so these computer programming methods can be useful with fairly large and complex sites. And in fact, you may have multiple contaminants and multiple screen intervals and things like that. And you can imagine that it can be very complicated to go through and try to determine an optimal solution without some software assistance. And so the other thing that I'm showing here is a map. And this just shows some of the interpolation methods. So basically, if you have a target, you know, N0 is the focal well, and then you have these neighboring wells, and you can use these different methods, Delaney triangles, Thiessen triangles, to interpolate between the values. Again, I'll put in a plug for the geospatial class because they talk a lot about different kinds of methods. But the reason why I put this up here is also to remind us that when we're doing a spatial analysis, be very aware of edge effects. And so in this case, I'm just illustrating, well, if this is actually our map, all these wells here would be on the edge. There would be no information outside of them. So we're doing well interpolating between these wells, but we have no information to estimate what's going on the outside. And that's a pretty important thing to look at. Okay, well, what about another method, just quickly to discuss as an approach? So this is basically kind of a screenshot of applying the geostatistical temporal spatial software. So we have some more information on this and other software in Appendix D, and you can read more about it. But this kind of gives you an overview of some of the methods there. And the GTS software actually uses some of these genetic algorithms to help solve for optimization. And what we're displaying here is a site plan map, and we can see some of the underlying features of that. There's some roadways over here, and we can see there's some buildings. An important thing for us are these plus symbols. The plus symbols are we have data, and so this is a site with a lot of data. You can see there's a lot of wells, certainly in some parts of the site. The other thing that it's showing here is basically a grid that the software has gone ahead and estimated concentrations. In this case, it's measuring, giving us the relative coefficient of variation, which is the measure of the variability related to the standard deviation of the data. And you can see at some points here, here's an example, there's two circles. It just illustrates that GTS actually has capability of dealing with more than one contaminant at a time, so it's showing you the relative uncertainty in two different contaminants. And so you can see this kind of map approach is pretty useful just even looking at it qualitatively. You can see that there's some small circles here. There's no wells. That's probably okay if we have low uncertainty and no wells. We can also see that there's some smaller circles, but there's a lot of wells. And so these are areas probably that there's redundancy. And you can look here and see that at the bottom, there's some large circles, and we see that there's no wells here. So at least for some contaminants, there would be a lot of uncertainty and not much data. And again, it's getting into what I mentioned also about potential edge effect down here too. So something to be aware of in terms of the estimation methods for the coefficient of variation. Well, just to wrap up here, there's basically optimization is something that conceptually you could do by yourself. You could take your data set and do it. But luckily, we have some tools, and it also highlights something that we have in the web-based guidance document this Appendix D. We have some different tools identified in Appendix D that can do some of this optimization, and I already mentioned some of these, the Mero software and VSP and GTS, and there's a couple other tools listed on this slide. And just to be aware, some of the tools have different capabilities and data requirements, and you can go through and look at Appendix D to get more information on that. And I think with that, I'll turn the presentation back over to Harold for the summary.
Okay, thanks, Randall. And before we conclude our training today, I would like to cover three more sections of the document, and that which are the statistical methods section, section 5, the software tools, go a little bit more detailed than Randall on the Appendix D, and then data management, which is in section 6. The statistical methods, basically the team looked at them and grouped them into applications, and so that Chris and Liz and Randall have all talked about particular methods and applications, and these are included in this Section 5. If you were to go to Section 5 and you pick, let's say you pick trends, it will take you to the group of methods that deal with trends. It will give you the relevant study questions that they answer, the assumptions and requirements, and strengths and weaknesses, and then links to the unified guidance document. We want you to understand that this is not intended as a how-to document, but as a resource, that we give you resources so that you can put your statistical plan together. Then, as Randall was talking about, software tools and packages in Appendix D, the team did a survey back in 2013-12 where they were trying to find out what the most used software packages were for dealing with groundwater statistics, and they came up with these 23 different software packages. And you should be careful to review any software to be sure it's applicable to your needs before you use it in your statistical evaluation. Some of the packages were designed for environmental data, while others are more general in their approach to business and scientific application. Each summary includes some of the practical information and costs. And so when you go to the Appendix D, you click on, you could first get a document, this table listing the different software packages, and then a list of 7 tables where you can, depending on which software, which method you were concerned with, such as non-detect or exploratory data analysis, and then that table would explain which software packages handle that group of methods. Or if you were to click on the software package as itself, it will take you to that software explaining the different information that's available, but also have a what we call under the statistical function box link, it has a capability table. And in this capability table, you're actually doing the opposite, where it's telling you all the different methods that the software package can handle, but and then what it has as well. If it's a filled-in black circle, that means it has full capability with that method. And then a half circle means that it has some capability and you're limited on dealing with the different parameters that it might use. And then if there's no circle, that means that it doesn't handle that process. And we have a little bit of a disclaimer here, remembering that this document was published in 2013, and since that time, this specific method does now include the Kaplan-Meier method in its handling the non-detect values. Then we go on to the section 6, where we talk about the groundwater data. And if you remember back at the beginning, the mounds of groundwater data that you have to deal with, this is where we discuss how to deal with this data. First of all, looking at the data and the data quality objectives. And in section 3.3.1, you'll find where it discusses how you and links to documents that help you to define what your data quality objectives are and how to refine your data to make sure that it's the data that will give you the correct answer. Then after that, on into section 6, we discuss how there's these different large databases, how they're put together, and we list a couple of them here on the screen. But in any case, most laboratories will send you the data in electronic format, and so therefore it would be best to already have your database set up so that you know what format you would want your data to come in and come straight into your database. In any case, we have in section 6 the stream, it discusses how to make the basic structure of your database and help so that you can handle your data in a consistent and efficient way. In our training today, Chris presented information on how to apply the statistical approach, and from that, we hope we've given you some confidence with handling statistical concepts and being better able to select the appropriate statistic method for your project, as well as the appropriate software tools to use. Then Liz and Randall discussed the application of the study questions to site activities, such that to determine background, understand the compliance, implement trend analysis, and also implementing monitoring optimization. These are four key areas that we chose for the training, but the guidance document also provides user-friendly explanations for other uses of statistics for your groundwater data. And with that, this document provides the project manager to use the appropriate statistical methods in addressing common project tasks and better make decisions for their project. You've learned how this web-based document goes together, and we hope that you will use it in your projects to make a better decision with your groundwater data. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Mary and for your additional questions.
Thank you, Harold. We now have a few minutes for some additional questions and answers. I do have a couple poll questions open. If you would take an opportunity to answer those, we would very much appreciate it. Just a reminder for those of you that are interested in continuing education documentation, we ask that everyone go ahead and fill out that feedback form, but especially for those of you interested in a certificate of participation, you complete that feedback form. There's a box for you to check at the end of that form to certify you participated today, and then a certificate of participation will be generated for you. And Harold, one of the things that you had noted, you know, that this document was published in 2013, so we're looking, you know, 5-6 years ago by now, and somebody is wondering, is there any plan to make any updates to this document in the future?
I saw that. I think that's something for the ITRC board to consider. As we look at it, you know, statistics are pretty much the same the way that we use them may, and the tools, you know, we've come up with additional tools to how to do statistical methods so that, and I think also there's been some additional requests about having a more in-depth statistical training as well, but at this point we have nothing in the works.
All right, thank you. A few questions here that we will be able to get to. It says, is there a cutoff point for which historical data just becomes too much? Like you just have too much data to be able to do anything with it.
I think it's probably more a question like Liz alluded to, which is the methods in some cases are not consistent in terms of getting detection limits for certain chemicals, in particular organic chemicals. I guess you could look at historically if there had been no site, no release, you know, you're just looking at there should be no trend then right in the groundwater. So you could be mixing together a lot of years of data where there's nothing going on with something going on, but there's probably, and it, so I guess it depends on your question. There's some cases where you probably have, it's not relevant. Some cases where it could be highly relevant because maybe it's gives you some information on what is background, for example. That was a question that came up.
But it says, should background samples be taken within a certain distance of your site?
That's a good question, and it has to do probably with the, you know, your conceptual site model and, you know, how similar or not the, you know, aquifers are. Ideally, that's why the intra-well testing is such an intriguing idea, because you have the same groundwater, but you just have it before there was a release. So as you get further from the site, there could be cases where, you know, you're not sampling the same, you know, aquifer any longer, and therefore it's not really appropriate. So, but we can't answer that question, you know, in general. It has to be answered specific to your site and the conceptual site model.
Right. We did have one person note that the link to the EPA Unified Guidance through our links page wasn't working, so I appreciate the person that let us know that, and we will have that fixed here soon. So we will get that updated.
Mary,
Yes.
I went ahead and went to our document, and our document still has the proper link to go to the Unified Guidance. So
okay.
if you open up our web-based document, which we hope everybody does, and the link there is still active and works.
All right. Thank you, Earl. All right, here's the question. It says, is the goal to achieve a wider or narrower confidence interval?
Well, I guess that's a good question. So, I think it gets to the question of how much data to have and optimization and having adequate data for your decision. So, ideally, the smallest interval would be the most ideal, but at some point you've characterized the data with enough precision such that you can make a decision. So that's the objective, is you need to identify, you know, how many samples in essence do I need to have to document a trend or show compliance or whatever the question is. So there is a benefit to more data. So in general, we probably prefer conceptually a smaller interval, but you know, the smaller interval will take more time and money to characterize. So that's where there's the trade-off.
All right, one more question here before we wrap up. It says, would you suggest any statistical method for very large sites with multiple contaminants, wells, and geological layers? So example, mega sites. Is there a statistical package that you think would be better for that type of site than a more simple site?
I guess I would just say probably some of the more specialized software for groundwater analysis as opposed to general packages. And I think a lot of those are not, there's not new ones from when we did the survey back in 2013. So I think you can go look at a, you know, Appendix D and you could get a feeling for that. I don't know if there is a particular one we'd want to highlight. I'd ask Carol or Chris if they felt like doing that.
Yeah, I think the best thing we can do at this point is refer people to that Appendix D, and then if you do have additional questions, please let us know and you can follow up with us on that. We do need to wrap up today. We certainly appreciate all the participants who took time out of your busy schedules to be with us today and for all the great questions. I know we weren't able to get to all those questions today, so if you would like to follow up and have your question answered by the trainers, feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we'll do our best to follow up with those questions. Thanks so much for our volunteer trainers. We really appreciate your expertise, not only to deliver the training today, but the multiple sessions you've delivered over the years, as well as developing the guidance document. Remember, we'd like to have everybody's feedback today, so please complete that feedback form. And if you're one of those who needs a certificate of participation, you can get one of those by completing the feedback form. Click the box to certify you attended, and then a certificate will be generated for you. If you have more questions about ITRC or would like to learn more about our training opportunities and available guidance documents, please go to itrcweb.org. That wraps us up for today. We appreciate your participation.